Greetings, humans. You have entered the command zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
We come from the land of the nice and snow, where the midnight sun, when the hot springs plow.
Good enough. That song about Norse mythology.
Oh, yeah.
And thus begins today's episode of the Command Zone Podcast. I'm your host, Shimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai. So we got a pretty special episode today.
Not only that, 6 pages of outline. It's going to be, I mean, we may go through it fast, but there's a lot of work that went into it. So that's notable.
This idea kind of blew up on us. So this is a special episode in the vein of our classic stats shows from a couple years ago. We had some members of our team, thank you, Manson and Craig, spend some time watching Commander gameplay videos online to gather some data so we can talk, tackle some interesting questions. So we're going to ask things like, how long is the average game? Like, how many turns? How many times on average do players cast their commanders? How many attacks are you likely to make or launch in any given game? And others. But first, we got to talk about our sponsors.
Yes, let me take this one away. I got some special messaging. CardKingdom.com/CommandZone. That is our affiliate link. You use that the moment you need to buy any cards, singles, magic products, sealed products, whatever you want from the magic world, this place has it. And I was recently talking to one of our friends there, Tara, and I was asking her about how things were going, and she relayed to me that things have been very tough. They've just barely opened their doors to have curbside pickup and stuff, but a lot of people had to be laid off. A lot of people had to, you know, sort of unfortunately be furloughed because of the nature of the world right now.
I mean, they had to shut down for multiple weeks.
Yeah, to the point where one of their owners, I believe, was in the house packing orders himself. So that goes to show the dedication that the company has. And we know a couple of those had some, a little bit of shipping delays and stuff. This is, of course, part of what it means to reopen in this current state of the world. So if you guys go to their website, they'll always keep you updated. But that's why I love cardkingdom.com/command zone. They have, you know, such an open communication with their audience. They're always there to tell us what's going on. And, you know, seeing the dedication of their owner packing cards in their own house to send out to people, that is something that shows that it is a company that goes above and beyond. And that's why we're proud to have them as sponsors. And that's why we want you to use the affiliate link whenever you buy your magic product.
Also, they did just let us know that they've got the C20 product back in stock. So it was sold out for a little while. So if you're still looking to pick up C20 stuff, cardkingdom.com/command zone. And while you're there or anywhere in the world at your LGS or at online retailers, you can check out our other sponsor, Witches Ultra Pro. They really do make the best stuff to protect all your game pieces. They make the Eclipse sleeves, which we always talk about, the best sleeves on the market. They have things like the Satin Tower, which are, you know, for my money, the best deck boxes to protect all of your cards. Awesome play mats. Ultra Pro really can be found everywhere, and they are the ones that Jimmy and I personally trust to protect our collections.
Yeah, and if you guys, by the way, like, make your battlefield look super awesome with Ultra Pro products, send us a picture. We want to see what it looks like on your side of the table, wherever you are in the world, because Josh and I haven't been able to get out to play very much, so we haven't we haven't been able to see, like, the cool deck box, nice play mat. So send it to us on social. We'd love to see it.
And the final way to support all of our content is directly. If you go to patreon.com/commandzone, you can contribute to our content and get to do things like interact with Jimmy and I each and every day on our Discord server or watch game nights before anybody else. Again, patreon.com/commandzone. And we call out one lucky patron every single episode. And this episode is dedicated to Austin Brayman. Austin, you rock.
Rock. Oh, one last notice. The Commander Summit 2020, the deadline is approaching June 12th, just 2 days away, I believe, when this video comes out. If you want your voice to be heard in the Commander world this year on a whole variety of topics, we have a lot of submissions coming in, and you can be one of them if you're part of the Commander community. We have all of the links in our Twitter and Facebook as well, and the deadline's very close, so all the information you need is there. We'd love to hear your voices. We had a blast putting them together last year, and it's gonna be just as fun this time.
Last year we had a lot of people after the deadline be like, I didn't know about it, I didn't get invited. Some people last year, we sent out individual invites. This year we're just opening it up to content creators in the community. So if you hear this, you still have time. Couple days though, look in the show notes for the link. That's probably the easiest way to find it for details on how to submit. All right, main topic, myths and misconceptions about Commander. You know, we say a lot of things during the show, and it's a lot of times
quite a lot.
Yeah, and when we're saying it, I'm not saying we don't believe that it's true, but it got us wondering kind of like, is it actually true? So
Or how true is it?
Right, exactly. So we'll just sort of off the cuff be like, I think people think they play their commander more than they do.
Right.
And okay, yes, I believe that's true when I say it, but it's not like I've done a scientific study and have a bunch of data to back that up. And so, yeah, it got us thinking, when we say things like that, or what are the things we say that are like that, that we could sort of fact check or double check? And so we came up with a list of questions and had our team break down a bunch of commander gameplay content to get some data back so that we can either back up or refute some of the common claims that we've often made on this show. So before we get into it, our sources, the gameplay videos that we use to sort of gather the data for this stuff, are our own Game Nights videos, MTG Mudsta, Commander Clash from MTG Goldfish, Affinity for Commander, which is a YouTube channel, and the Commander Guys. Obviously, there's a ton of other Commander content out there. We're not saying that these are our favorites or we don't like the other ones. What we're saying is that for the purposes of this study, I'm going to put study in quotation marks there, these are the channels that sort of feature the type of games that we needed. So there's some stuff we were looking for. Most of the games on these channels are what we would consider to be in the 6 to 8 power level range, which is what we generally talk about on the show. So we steered away from competitive EDH channels.
I think we're also, that's about the majority of where people land, is between sort of that area for deck playing. So this is, we're trying to appeal to a larger audience here for this.
Yeah, our experiences from our playgroup and also playing at live events and stuff is generally people are in the 6 to 8 range. So we wanted that to be true. We tried to avoid gathering data from what I would call abnormal games. Right. So that's games that are sort of have off-the-wall themes, maybe games that were all pre-con decks, or games where they said, you know what, any Planeswalker can be legal as commander for this game, or we're using silver-bordered cards, or whatever.
Right, fun themes.
Yeah, if we found a game like that on one of these channels, we just skipped it, and we didn't use it for the data, because we wanted the data to be indicative of sort of your average game of commander.
That's great. All the games that were tested, by the way, 109 of them, let's not kid around, right? That's a lot of games tallied.
That was for some of the data points. For some, it's a slightly less, but yeah, keep going.
Slightly less. I'll throw the big number out there. You know? We're 4-player games, so...
Yeah, we didn't do any 5, any 3. It's only 4-player games, again, because the data is just going to get all over the place, and your sample size is going to not be worth a lot. So we just stuck to 4-player games.
Yeah.
And I'll admit, our sample size is a little bit small. For most of this stuff, it's just under 50 games. So we're not talking, we won't be referencing the data as if it's an absolute truth. Or if we do, we don't mean to.
Yeah.
It's more of like a clue. It's
an arrow pointing in a direction.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Exactly. It can back up your assumptions or refute them and cause us to rethink things. For our stats episodes, if you remember, this was while you were in New Zealand, Jimmy, shooting Mulan.
Right, winning this colors, all those things.
Yeah, we had over 300 games of data for that, and we're planning to revisit that in-depth stats stuff. This is kind of our toe back in the water, and we are going to use the data we collected here for that study as well. So we're going to have a much bigger sample size when we do that in the future, but this is answering some slightly different questions than that one is. So just a small disclaimer that, yes, this is a smaller sample size, and we're not trying to say this is an absolute truth when we point to stuff. It's just indicators that we can kind of look to. So let's start with the first topic, the first question, which is average game length.
Yeah, and also we encourage you, if you're at home, to be guessing and listening along and saying what you think out loud when you're listening, because there are some parts of this document that are blacked out to me.
Yeah, Jimmy,
that I don't know the percentages of.
We purposely didn't tell Jimmy the outcome when we crunched the numbers so that at least one of us here would be able to kind of guess at it. So we often talk about how everyone thinks that Commander games sort of go longer than they actually do. And this is something we noticed from doing game nights because, you know, that kind of forced us to take detailed notes, and we knew the game length of all the game nights. And we kind of noticed a pattern, which was, I think people out there in the wild tend to think Commander games are like on average like 15, 16, 17 turns long, when from game nights experience, it tends to be lower than that.
What do you guesstimate usually? You usually say
around 12.
12, yeah.
Yeah, is my general what I've thrown out there on the podcast many times, right?
I guess I kind of land around that area with like it could end earlier, but if it hasn't ended at that point, it's going to peter out by then.
Yeah, I mean, if you had to guess, Jimmy, what would you say is the turn on which the average commander game ends?
The average commander game ends, based on just all my years of playing commander, I'm going to say 10 or 11, maybe.
Okay.
Just because I think 9's a little too early for the 6 to 8 power level, and yeah, I'm going to say around, maybe turn 11. I like that number, 11.
So turn 11 is Jimmy's guess. So again, for the turn data, we were able to tally more games because it's a lot easier. On a lot of content, you can just click to the end of the game and they're keeping track of turns. One of the reasons we actually chose some of the content creators we did is because they are keeping track of turns, and it was very easy for us to gather this specific data point. So we, 109 games tallied here, and the average game ends on, quick out there, everybody can guess before I give the answer.
Turn
10.29.
Oh, so it's closer to 10.
It's closer to 10 than 11, but it is in between 10 and 11. So your average game is slightly before turn 11.
Okay. And of course, this is the statistical average.
Correct.
So you have to take a little bit of that into consideration because you could have things weigh it more. Like you could have a bunch of 8-turn games and not as many 9s, but that will weigh it down towards the 10 more than, you know, there's some intricacy there.
Yeah. So the interesting thing here is we actually broke it down by turns. So 8-turn games were 14% of the sample.
14? Man, those are fast.
9-turn games were 21% of the sample. So about 1 in 5 games was a 9-turn game, and that is statistically the most likely length of a game that you're going to play.
Hmm.
Turn 10 was about 11%, turn 11 was about 14%, and then turn 12 was about 10%.
So
between turns 8 and 12, that grouping, that's about 70% of all the games in our sample. So you're very likely that a game's going to end between turn 8 and turn 12. Obviously, there were some outliers. The longest game we had in the whole sample was 19 turns, and that was one game. There was one 18-turn game. Everything else was under that. We had no games in the entire sample that were 5 turns or below, also, which shows you that we didn't use CEDH games.
Right.
And then we had about 4 games that were 6 turns and 5 games that were 7 turns. I think that's why 9-turn games are the most common, but the average actually skews a little bit higher at 10.29 because there are more games in the 13, 14, 15 range than there are in... There's no games that are 4 below, right?
Right. It's easier to have a game end on turn 13 plus than it is for 5 and below.
Right, exactly.
And the outliers in general, you do want to keep a note of them, but sometimes, you know, it's a game of commander. Sometimes you can get into a situation where two people just have a pure stalemate and they're the only two players left in the game. So that may... Like, you could argue, right, the game may be ended... for everyone else like 5 or 6 turns ago, but for the outliers one, it's always good to just keep in mind that we don't really know, unless you're going in there, like, you don't know, sometimes just wonky circumstance can make those happen.
But I mean, representative of that is that it's one game in the sample, and there's no games that went 20 turns or more in the whole sample.
That's because there's an unwritten rule that you just concede.
You scoop if it hits. We're about 20. To hit turn 20. Who's ahead?
Everyone, we're out of here.
So the questions to ask here is, what does this mean, and sort of how should this affect a couple of different aspects? One is deck building.
Yes, absolutely.
So if you know games are going 10.29, which for both of us seems like it was even a little faster than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I used to say 12. You said 11
here. Yeah.
It's and I think for a lot of people out there, 10.29 is well under what they would have guessed. Obviously, it's going to vary from playgroup to playgroup and whatnot. But I think games are just generally less turns than you think, because turns near the end of the game tend to take longer.
Right.
More and so it feels, it can feel like two rotations happened when actually only one rotation happened just because the amount of time it took.
Dude, there's sometimes where after a combat step, the other person starts taking their turn because that took so long to just get through combat.
It must be my turn now.
Yeah.
So anyway, how should this info affect our deck building specifically?
Well, this is the same thing we had when the Mulligan rule changed and we realized that you couldn't get as greedy with the partial Paris. In general, you don't want to get, you know, on the bad side of it, which is like if you're not able to play a bunch of spells by the end of the game and you just have way too high costed stuff, you're probably not in a great position because you don't have the time to develop out and have the freedom to be like, turn 14, now I can do so much. Well, the game's probably over at that point. So what are you holding on the cards in your hand at that point? Probably not great.
Yeah, I think it's a curve consideration thing. Like if there are more turns in the lower end, like more, you're going to spend more time playing, you know, turns 1 through 8 than you are going to spend times playing, you know, turns 9 through 13.
Oh,
right?
I see. Right.
Then that means that you just generally want not as many high casting cost spells, because if games were going on average 16 turns, then all of a sudden you're spending a lot of time every game in the higher end of the spectrum where you have a lot more mana available. And so having 7 plus CMC spells, you're going to be able to cast those spells. But what I think we're seeing is if the games are going to be, you know, under 11 turns on average, then you're just not going to have as many chances to deploy really expensive spells, and you probably want to have less of them in your deck.
I mean, think about it this way. If a game is on average ending at 10, let's just say 10, and by turn 3 you just pass the turn, that's 30% of your game where you haven't done anything. And those are games typically when they happen to you, you just don't draw the right ramp, or maybe your curve's too high. You do really feel behind, especially because it seems like everyone just kind of has, right, 2-mana rocks with the Arcane Signets and all the Signets out now. Definitely encourage players to build towards the 2-end as opposed to the 5-mana ramp side.
I really like that as a way to think about it, right? You have less time to catch up if you fall behind early. Yeah. So you really want to make sure your deck can do things early in the game, because you're going to have less time later in the game because there is less late game than we think.
Yeah.
If the games were going to 15 turns on average, then if you don't do anything on turn, you know, 1, 2, and 3, you have a lot more time to catch up. But if the games are going 10 turns, you know,
that's a huge chunk of your game.
That's like if you were running a race and you're like, I have more stamina than the other person. They get off to a big lead and you're thinking, I still have 4 laps of the track to catch them. Well, if you suddenly go, there's one lap left, not 4, it's like, oh crap, I don't have as much time as I thought for my endurance to kind of play out here.
And those players and the people running around also are getting faster and faster because they are ramping out. So it's almost like the kind of thing where you don't, sometimes we talk about, yeah, sandbag a little bit, hold stuff back. But if you don't establish yourself on the board at all, you're the kind of player that's going to get pecked away at and you're going to die really fast. Or you're just not going to be able to catch up with the extra speed that everyone else added to their game before you even started that engine.
Mm-hmm. All right, and the other question I think to ask, and we're going to ask these two questions with all this stuff, mm-hmm. which is, okay, now we have this info, not only how do we deck build, but now how should knowing this affect how we play, what our in-game decisions are?
Interesting.
So I think one of the things is if you, you know, knowing this, you have to start sort of being ready sometime around probably like turn 7 to either start knocking people out or stopping other people from knocking you out or winning the game.
Yeah, and CEDH, by comparison, this happens as early as turn 0, turn 1, right? Yeah. So, like, that's how fast CEDH is. But that is a huge part of the game that makes it really interesting to them, which is, how do you stop this person from winning, or how do I execute my win condition? In regular Commander games that aren't competitive, I guess we're seeing this is much more of a consideration at around 8.
Yeah, I'd say 7, 8. Probably don't want to just tap out and play something and leave yourself vulnerable, because mm-hmm. if you're not the player that's going to be trying to end the game, then somebody in the pod probably is, because we see many games ending around turn 8, 9, 10, mm-hmm. and they're going to start making their move in there, and so you have to be ready for it. And so I think keeping track of what turn we're on will help you sort of know when somebody's going to put their foot on that gas pedal, and you can be ready for it with your removal spell. So maybe you choose, okay, I'm going to play a 5-drop and leave these 3-mana open so I can stop somebody, because this is about the time in the game where somebody's going to try and make that big move.
Yeah, and you're able to, unless you need to protect something earlier on, you can be a little more safe doing things on turns 3 through 6. But the closer you edge towards the end of the game, I think the more people are also just collectively going to have their eyes on, like, who's going to win and how now.
I was thinking of this sort of as the, when you're in a game, you maybe use those early turns to kind of get the lay of the land and try and figure out which player is the player that's going to push and make that move first.
Right.
And you also need to figure out, is that me?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to be the player in this game that somewhere around turn 7 or 8 tries to start closing it out? Because somebody's going to be that player. And if I'm not that player, if I determine, okay, that's not how the game's played out for me and what my hand looks like and what my deck's doing, then I need to maybe switch gears into the, okay, well, somebody's going to be that player and I need to be able to stop them. And I need to play in such a way that I leave my options open to stop a big move, because I know around the range that it's going to happen, and it's around turn 8.
I mean, this is also a great political thing too, which is, like, I've seen this deck go off. I know that they're ramping and they're going to be able to expropriate around 7, which usually is going to turn into a win by 9. So let's get wary of that. Let's know what's happening. And if you're that player, you try to disguise that fact.
Yeah, it's either like, on your toes, everybody, or, oh, nothing's going on here, don't be on your toes, don't worry about it.
It's kind of like the beatdown slash who's the, in regular limited Magic. You got to know who's pushing the thing forward, the cart forward, because if everyone just sits and waits for someone to do it, then that's not really playing Magic either.
All right, so that's going to cover the average turn length discussion. We're going to move on to the next point here, which is related. So we're just talking about mana curve, and specifically big mana spells, 7 CMC plus spells. So we're going to talk about big splashy spells, because Commander, it was originally kind of pitched to me as the format where big the big splashy spells could actually be cast. And I think you and I have both felt as the years have gone on, you know, we've been doing this for, what, 6 years almost now.
It's been going down, that number.
Yeah, you just, it's not, like, Insurrection used to be, like, almost a staple. It's an 8-mana spell, and I really don't play it at all anymore because it's too expensive.
Yeah.
Games just don't go as long as they used to, and you just can't play that many 8-drops. That's how we feel, right?
Yeah, and if you're playing something like an Expropriate, you want to be ramping out to it to get it out earlier.
Expropriate's so powerful, you need all your big mana spells to be that powerful. Right. Otherwise, like you can't just play like a Diluvian Primordial maybe because it's like, yeah, it's a good card, but that's a lot of mana.
Is it
going to
close out the game? Nah, yeah, right.
But this is the rhetoric we've been throwing out there with no real data, so now we're going to try and get some data here. And the question we asked was, how many big spells does a player cast on average in a game? I want to make two notes here. These data points are a little bit harder to gather, so we have a smaller sample size of games, again, just under 50. But remember, there are four players in each game, so we're still getting the data from about 200 different
200
players.
200 people, yeah.
Yeah. Note number two is we only counted, for this quote-unquote study, we only counted it if a player actually cast the spell and paid the mana for it.
Tap lands.
Yeah, or it could be lands, Cygnus, mana, dork, whatever, Cygnus, yeah. Whatever. But if it was cheated out, then we didn't entered into the data set. So, because that didn't tell us much, right? Like, obviously, if you're playing Joda or Braids or something, you want to have more high CMC stuff than normal.
Yeah, or any reanimator stuff.
Yeah, if you've got synergy that allows you to cheat mana cost, then it's a totally different conversation. What we're talking about is 7 CMC or more or higher spells. How many of them should you have in your average deck? How many are you likely to play? So here we go. Average number of 7 plus CMC spells cast per game, total by the entire table.
This blew my mind, by the way.
Yeah.
I would have, but okay.
What would you think?
Average, okay, it's 10 turn average on in general. That means everyone's going to have at least 7 mana. I'm going to say 6 or more 7 plus CMC spells.
So, you know, about
each
1.5
per
player.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody's going to cast 2, a couple are going to cast 2, and a couple are going to cast 1. What we see is much lower than that. 2.38 7 CMC or more spells per game by the table.
That's 0.6 per player, so not even that's insane.
So you cast a 7 CMC or larger spell on average, hard cast, you know, not cheat out or whatever, on average about a little more than every other game.
Yeah, a little over half. Yeah, that to me is very surprising.
Yeah, that's crazy. Another crazy stat here is in 19% of the games in the study, almost 1 in 5 games, there was not a single 7 plus CMC spell cast by any player.
Wow. Wow.
So 7 mana or more is kind of this threshold where as soon as you cross it,
it just gets very hard to do that and stay, you know, alive or like hold open mana to do stuff. I feel like 6 is the sweet spot for the top end now.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, and we don't know, obviously, from any of these content, what's in people's hands.
Right.
But we can imagine that, you know, they have 7 CMC spells sometimes and can't cast them or don't feel comfortable casting them because of the way that the game has progressed. And just tapping out and using all your mana for this one thing doesn't feel like the right thing to do. Quickly, some outliers. So the most 7 plus CMC spells we saw cast by a single player in a game was 4.
Was that Craig?
One game.
Hellish Norn 4 times.
I don't know the specifics. That was one player in one of the games hard cast 4 7 plus CMC spells, and then there were 2 players that cast three of those spells in different games.
Okay. So let's ask the two questions we're gonna ask here after every stat, which is, what does this mean and how does this affect and how should this affect your deck building? Well, same point as we had just last time. The big spells, if you're not going to be able to play that many or they're just not tenable, it seems now, shouldn't put as many in your deck.
Yeah, I think your 7 plus CMC, you know, most deck building apps, they'll show you your curve.
Right.
And they'll have this graph, and there'll be a bunch in the 1 and the 2, and the 3 will usually be huge, and then it'll taper down 4, 5, 6. And then at 7 and everything after that, you don't want very many. I mean, it might be like 3 or 4 in your whole deck.
Yeah, and you want to have ways of cheating it out. And like, for instance, Cyclonic Rift, you could say, is a 7 CMC spell, but it has another option on it. So
it's a big difference being able to still cast it for 2, right?
Right.
Because that's actually more likely to happen, I think, than we think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas 7 plus, you don't want to draw two of them because you're almost never going to cast two of them in the same game.
16 mana or whatever, right?
Yeah.
To cast. Well, another thing interesting, too, is that like we have gotten a little harsher and we have to be a little more strict in how we grade these spells.
Mm, good point.
Because we have to, if you're going to only play one of them, it can't just be like a single use, like, well, this is really good in this scenario, but not many others. I feel like these are cards that just generically have to be so powerful that they're going to affect the board at the proper 7 CMC level, you know.
They have to be worth it. They have to be good.
It. Yeah.
It's like I was talking about Diluvian Primordial earlier, which is a very strong spell. Cast instants and sorceries out of your opponent's graveyard.
Yeah, totally.
But I don't put it in very many decks because it costs so much mana and I don't know what it's going to do when I play it. And if I'm going to stick my neck out and cast my 1-7 CMC spell that I'm going to probably cast in the entire game, I want it to be Mind's Dilation, you know? Right. I want it to have a huge effect on the game and get me a ton of value guaranteed, whereas Diluvian Primordial might get me like a removal spell and a Cultivate.
Or a Brainstormer, yeah. Just like small stuff, right? And like, yeah, it's, oh, cool, you ramped up, played your sweet 7-drop Diluvian Primordial and no one's cast anything, so
you can't
use
a board wipe that I don't want. Or
you know? Totally.
Yeah, and a counterspell that I can't use, yeah.
I mean, in general, we always have this, I think, ongoing mentality here at the Command Zone, which is like, if there's an uncertainty about it, generally trend away from it because there's so many players, so many deck types, and so many cards in Magic's history that the uncertainty, the danger of it, I feel like just multiplies in value in games like this, so...
I think also if you're going to play a deck that is an exception to this rule, like we said, Joda, Braids, those decks that are going to cheat things.
Eldrazi decks, yeah.
Yeah, they're going to get around the mana cost and not hard cast the big stuff. I think this tells you to make sure that you have reinforcements, backups, redundancy for the cheating part of it. Make sure that you have other ways to cheat things into play because you don't want to be in a situation where like your Joda gets killed and now you're hard casting your 7 CMC spells, which we know is very hard to do. You need something else out there that allows you to, you know, Quicksilver Amulet or something that just allows you to still play cards, because if you're just relying on, you know, ramping and hard casting stuff, it's just not likely to happen.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I could have swore this number would have been so much higher. And,
yeah.
But, you know, looking back at decks that we've built recently, and I think you can see this, the 7, 8, 9 to 11 slot, you just see one or two just a little peppered in there.
Yeah, you just can't afford to run, you know, 8 of those cards in your deck because you're just going to be glutted with them. You know,
and I've done that so many times, even if it's just too many 6-drops even.
Yeah.
Too many 5-drops. Having 2 5-drops in your hand, you need 10 mana to get those out. That's the end of the game if you're not playing ramp. Like that definitely affects a lot of how I feel. Look at this now.
Yeah, and I like what you said there, because I think one of the things you generally want to get to the point in any game of Commander is doing two things in a turn.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very hard to do 7 CMC worth of something and something else. And so often we know, and this might be related to game length, right? If you know the game, once you have 7 mana, the game's getting close to the end because you must be on turn 6, 7, 8, right? So you can't afford to just play a 7-drop because that might give the window to the player that's now trying to win because you're around that time. Mm. So what you often want to do is be like, I want to advance my board with something like a 4-drop, but hold my 3 or 4 mana open with an answer to stop people from winning. Because like we said, one of the things you can learn from the earlier question, the average game length, is when to get ready to stop people from knocking everybody out.
Yeah, and again, this is why Force of Will, Pact of Negation is so good, is that you can have a little more freedom to play the big CMC spells and hold up something at the other end of it.
All right, the other question is, so we know that, you know, 7 CMC spells are pretty rare and you're not going to hard cast a lot of them. How should this info affect your in-game decision-making?
Well, I guess at this point, let's say everyone's listened to this episode, everyone's now watching in an agreement, right? My CMC spells, big ones, need to be super impactful. Well, if they're permanents or creatures, probably going to need to remove them quickly, otherwise they will take over the game.
Yeah, because you know the high CMC stuff other people are going to play. It must be really good if they're putting it in there.
I mean, do you think Paradox Engine could have been fine as a 7-drop?
Probably. I mean, think of our preview card for M21.
Right.
Chromatic Orrery. And our biggest complaint about it was, well, it's 7 mana. Like, you know, it's just going to sit there for so long. And then once I get to 7, the stuff I'm doing was... When I use 7 mana to do something, it has to do more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or on turn 7, however you want to phrase it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely you're going to see really high power stuff at that level. And I think just having good threat assessment is really important here and knowing which ones you need to remove or at least inform the table. Like if it's Zendikar Resurgent and it's a creature-based deck, you got to get rid of that.
Yep, absolutely. All right, we are going to go on. We've got other questions. We're going to talk about how often players cast their commanders per game. That's a really interesting one. How many combat steps and attacks players generally get into per game? We're going to talk about board wipe frequency. A bunch of cool, interesting questions coming up, but we're going to take a quick break and hear a message from our sponsors.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hey, I'm Nolan Sykes, a host of Past Gas, the number one automotive podcast in the world. Every week, my co-hosts, James Pumphrey, Joe Weber, and I bring you some of our favorite stories from the hallowed halls of car history. From the amazing to the weird to the utterly unforgettable moments, we cover it all. Join us as we take a look at the wild stories and larger-than-life characters behind legendary cars and car makers. So if you love cars or just like a good story, check out Past Gas by Donut Media, the number one automotive podcast in the world.
All right, we are back talking about Commander myths and misconceptions and the things that we think we know for sure, but we'll get proven wrong on this episode, as I have now been a few times, and I'm sure it will continue, because this one, I know I'm going to get the answer wrong.
So this is Commander frequency. We believe a lot of players build their decks thinking they're going to cast their commander very often every game, like 3+ times.
Cool, Briar!
Yeah, and we've often come on and said that we don't think that's true, but you know, until now, it was just a feeling we had. We've tried to get some data to see if this is true or not. So, on average, how often do people actually cast their commander in a single game? Note, we're only counting times where people cast their commander from their command zone for this data. So, if it gets bounced back to your hand and you cast it, that doesn't count. If you reanimate from your graveyard or something, that doesn't count. It's just how many times do you pay commander tax, or we also count the first time you cast it. So,
Well, the important question though is, does the commander tax severely limit the number of times you cast your commander, or is it okay that it goes 2, 4, 6?
Because there's often a feeling, I think, that it's no big deal if my commander dies because I'll just recast it. And you have that idea in your head when you're building your deck, and you just kind of, it's a given, you're going to have access to your commander. If you need to, you can recast it. Right. They can't really. And so how many times do people actually play their commander in any given game?
I would say 3+.
You think the average is 3+?
That would be my guess before I started this episode. Now I know it's probably lower.
That's the way it's trending.
Right? Yeah.
All right. So, you're correct as far as that it will be lower than your guess. The average number of times a player casts their commander per game is 1.4.
Not that low that I was expecting.
It's half what you thought. Yeah.
Jeez.
So that's less than you will like. How do I put this? Okay. In two games, on average, you will not cast your commander 3 times. It'll be slightly below than that.
And again, smaller limited pool size, but this does, I mean, right? It would, if this smaller pool size was super inaccurate, it might say 1.4, but it appears that this is a pretty accurate size. Like maybe we analyze another 100 games, it's 1.5.
Yeah. It's not going to double or something, right? It's not going to 3.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the important thing for me here is like, holy moly, you're casting your commander once, and if it dies, you're just saying it's not worth it a lot of times.
A lot of times, yeah. Now, I know a lot of people out there are going, okay, but not all commanders are created equal. Mm-hmm. It totally should be different depending on what the CMC of the commander is true.
Right.
Or sorry, of the commander is, right? And that's kind of true. So what we did is we broke down these numbers a little further to see the average number of times a player casts their commander per game considering the CMC.
Right.
So here we go. If your commander is between 3 and 4 mana CMC, then you're going to cast it on average 1.47 times per game. So only slightly above the average.
All right. Makes sense.
If it's 5 or 6, so a little bit bigger, a little more expensive, you're going to cast your commander about 1.3 times per game.
So less than the average.
A little drop, but they're similar, right? That's not a huge difference. If your commander is 7 CMC plus, you're going to cast it an average of 0.77 times per game. You will not average even casting your commander every game.
You might not ever have the opportunity in the window based on what we were just talking about, right?
Yep.
Your Sam CMC spell is your massive commander. Good job. Unless it's like Maelstrom Wanderer, you're not going to get that much off it immediately. Someone else just ends the game. So maybe you have to be like, can't cast McPanner, got to answer.
It's just a danger of building a deck with a high CMC commander is that you may not cast it. Now, 2 CMC, we saved it for last. Because I think most people would think you're going to play 2 CMC a lot more. Because the difference, you know, 2 then 4 then 6, that's like doable, right? Yeah. 2 CMC commanders are cast an average of 1.86 times per game.
So none of them even made it across the 2x threshold. And I'm here guessing that we're casting our commanders 3 times a game.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I would have thought it would be above 2. I would have thought on average you're casting your commander a second time.
Right, because the first time you pay 2 mana on top, not so bad. But if you look at these CMCs, if it's a 4 CMC commander, it costs 6 and then it costs 8.
Yeah, you're never casting
it for the third time. Yeah, the game is ending at that point.
And some games you're not doing it the second time, and that's why it's trending below 2.
Right.
2 CMC is really interesting, and we thought about it for a while. I think it could be that 2 CMC commanders maybe don't get killed as often, so you don't have as much chance to replay them, right? Because 2 CMC commanders often outclass later in the game, so it's just not worth it for your opponents to get rid of. Because you don't see a lot of 2 CMC commanders that have like crazy synergistic abilities. There's a few, but it's Kinnan,
Bonder.
They just made them.
Origin.
But a lot of them are not like, by turn 8, you're looking at their 2 CMC commander going, whatever, there's bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
And also, the third time you cast your 2 CMC commander, it's 6 mana.
It should be a 6 mana power level card,
right? A 2 drop, I see. You're like, I'm not casting that for 6. I'm going to play a 6 drop out of my hand, right? A lot of times.
Unless it's crucial for making your deck work. But at that point, like you said, there aren't that many commanders that have that amount of crazy synergy.
Yeah, typically, maybe like Hapatra or something. Okay, I need the negative 1 counter.
Or Skullbriar. My deck's based around that's Voltron. At this point, I think the thing that we've seen is like the ones that have those abilities tacked onto it that are just that powerful, the lowest they'll go is like 4 CMC with that.
Yep.
Urza is the best example. And then you look at the Chulainn's, like that's sort of where I think, and geez, I'm not casting Chulainn twice. I've had to do that before.
Yeah.
It sucks. You're like, all this value I have to wait to get to.
One thing we found that was interesting for the 7 plus CMC commanders, if you're playing one, in our sample, about 1/3 of the games, 33% of the time, they were cast 0 times.
Right, because it's 0.77 is the average.
Yeah, so in 1/3 of your games, if you have a 7 CMC or more commander, you will not cast it.
That's a bummer. You're kind of building your deck around your commander, aren't you?
You probably in 7 CMC, if your commander 7 CMC or more, you probably should build around it less than you would in most decks. I mean, there's obviously exceptions. I think you mentioned Maelstrom Wanderer earlier. Yeah. And I remember one of the games in our sample did have a Maelstrom Wanderer deck, and it's one of the ones that brings up the average. I think it was cast 3 times in that game.
Well, there you go. Interesting.
Yeah, because those decks are often built with just pure mana ramp into Maelstrom.
And get it out, have the effect repeat itself as many times as possible.
Yeah, but still, that's pretty interesting. All right, let's go on to the two questions we've been asking. So the first one is, what does this mean? How should this info affect deck building?
I mean, and at the very least, just don't rely on always recasting your commander in games, right? Don't build your deck so that you don't have anything else to do in your hand but recast your commander. In fact, I would say the number one like vibe that you get when someone's like, this is the third time I'm thinking back to this game where Kenji cast Numot like 3 times.
Yeah.
Is you just see this just sorrowful look of this is all I can do at this point, so I got to do this. I don't think you ever want to be in that position.
You're not winning that game, right?
Yeah, you're not feeling good. You're not feeling, your hand sucks, that sucks, like, oh no.
I'm paying 9 mana for something that should cost 5. Yeah. It's just not
It's not doing anything, it can't even swing.
I think you don't want to make deck building choices that assume you're going to be casting your commander multiple times too. So I think a lot of people look at their commander's kind of enter the battlefield effect and they go, I'm going to get that effect over and over because I'm just keep casting it out of the command zone. You're not going to do that. Now, if you're blinking it, if you're doing other things, that's fine. But as far as like just hard casting it out of the command zone, you're just not going to do that.
Yeah.
You're probably not even going to do it twice.
I think it also means that you should be more protective of how you're doing it and timing it right. Because it doesn't mean you have to cast this on curve. It just means that you want to cast it for the best rate possible. And having to redo it because you maybe played your commander turn too early can be really feel bad.
I think like the Fury cycle, the one we like here is Fury Storm.
Right.
Or sorry, it's the Storm cycle, not the Fury cycle.
Yeah.
the Fury Storm is the two red, and it copies, it forks something, but based it forks it for how many times you've cast your command out of the command zone. The only one we like out of that whole cycle, there was Echo, Imperial, Genesis, and Skull. Mm-hmm. Skull Storm costs 9 mana, and it cares about how many times you've cast your commander out from the command zone. All those are bad, and you basically never see them, except Fury Storm, which is the one that you say, 4 mana, if I copy something twice, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, because it's just at its base value.
Yes. Right?
Instead of a 9 mana spell where it's like, geez, I mean, at that point, had you to get the full value, you've cast your commander 3 times. That is a 9 mana spell on top of another 9 mana spell. Ooh.
Yeah, unlike you've done that. There's that card Commander's Insignia, which like it's an anthem effect for your whole team,
right,
but it scales so they get +1/+1 for how many times you've cast your commander.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just not worth it because you're not likely to have cast your commander as many times as you think. In fact, you're likely to have cast it only once.
Yeah, this also means that you can disrupt your opponents a lot more by taking out their commanders, playing more board wipe, spot removal, counterspell. That type of stuff is going to, it actually has a much bigger impact than we may have surmised originally.
Yeah, and that leads into our next question, which is how should this affect your in-game decision making? I think you've made two good points about that. One is be careful about when you play your commander and when you time it. If it's super important to your deck, you probably want to have protection ready for it, or play it in a moment where you don't think they're going to instantly remove it.
Or you can do another spell on top and at least get some value out of it.
Yeah, because if you got to consider what happens if somebody untaps and immediately removes this thing.
Right.
Do I want to pay? Yeah, I think we feel like, in our mind, I'll just run my commander out there because I can get it back later, but you're not probably going to want to pay that a lot of times, so you got to be careful about that. And then on the flip side is what you just said, which is removing somebody's commander, it feels bad, right? Because I'm going to kill this thing, and they still have it, kind of.
And they have a 0.4% chance of doing it again, or like 1.4, right? Like, they've cast it once, the chance they do it again, that's way lower than the first time they cast it.
So it actually is better than it feels like to get rid of their commander. Oftentimes, they're not going to cast it again in that game, but I think sometimes we're hesitant to use our removal spell on their commander because it just feels like they can just get it back. But the reality of the situation is, it's actually not that efficient for them to do that, and they won't want to do that most of the time.
You're kind of time-walking them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, so be maybe more willing to use your removal on their commander. And from experience, that is the way you handle a lot of very strong decks, the Chulainn decks, the Yaruk decks, the Selvala decks. If you can immediately kill that thing, a lot of times the deck is severely nerfed because it sets them back so far.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. 1.4?
Yeah, I know. When we saw that number, all of us here at the office were like, what?
Yeah.
I thought it would be over 2. I thought it'd be like 2.2, 2.3.
I'd be interested also to see if you are able to scan a lot of partner commander games, because then these Fury cycles get a little bit better, right? If you cast both them once, then you get a 2 count on the 10 times you cast your commander from the command zone.
And with all this stuff, I think, you know, the specifics of the deck will have to be taken into account, because, of course, 7 CMC plus spells are very good in certain decks. Like we said, Jota, Braids, things like that. Mm-hmm. But this, we're talking about the average deck. Like, most decks are not those decks. So there's certainly some decks where, yes, you're going to cast your commander a lot of times by design. That's how the commander is sort of designed to play.
Right.
But on your average deck, most commanders, you're just not going to cast it as many times as you think.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to the next topic.
Your favorite.
Combat and attacks. At this point, I'm assuming people attack 0 times per game. That's just going to be my...
I think we've kind of talked about, or at least spoken about, combat as if
it doesn't exist.
It's more rare than people think. Like, it happens less than people think.
I still hold by that. That seems to be the case. Early turns, yes. Later turns on, it just kind of goes away. Unless it's like one big swing to end the game.
So how... These are our thoughts from before, right? So now we're actually asking the questions from the data. How prevalent is combat? How likely is it that you'll actually get to swing with your creatures? So this one, I'm going to warn you, we may have to question our assumptions a little here.
Okay,
so something to note, we counted any attack as a single attack. So it didn't matter if a player swung with one creature or 50 creatures, or swung at one player or multiple players. Mm-hmm. That was counted as an attack. Now, if they got an extra combat step, that counted as another attack.
Gotcha.
But the number of creatures or how much you're hitting for...
That didn't matter.
Okay. So the average number of attacks launched by any given player in a game is... 2.86.
So almost 3 times they turn creature sideways?
Yeah, almost 3 per game.
You know,
but
that,
under 3.
That feels right to me, because not many people are building aggressive decks, so they're not attacking that much. A lot of the times, the best times to attack are the early turns, and people are ramping out or playing Land of War Elves, and those things certainly aren't swinging in. And very rarely do you see, like, you know, just a little chip damage coming in from a little 1-1 or whatever. So that feels a about right. But also, like, not every deck is built to attack, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. When I saw the 2.86, I had the same reaction as you, which is like, okay, yeah, we've kind of been right about that.
Yeah, good job us.
Yeah, but then we kind of started thinking about it some more, and we said, well, it's not really fair, that number. It doesn't feel fair, because some decks literally are never going to attack you, and they aren't built to attack you, like Mizzix decks or all kinds of decks that are spell-based.
That's going
to
pull the average down a lot.
Yeah, exactly, and so they just have zero attacks, and they never want it to attack, so... The question we then want to ask is, okay, well, what are the average number of attacks launched by a combat player in a game?
Ah.
And we define combat player as the player in the pod in any given game who attacked the most times.
Okay, so they're the ones, I'm the Craig Blanchett dog biting on, this is my deck's purpose, I'm going to swing more.
Right, and in most games, there was a singular player who attacked a lot more than the other players.
Okay.
And that average... So average number of attacks launched by the combat player was 5.25 attacks per game.
Okay, so that's actually attacking at least if a game, again, yep. We're assuming games end at turn 10.
Ish, yeah.
You're attacking 50% of the time.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot.
That's way higher than I would think.
Yeah.
You know, again, I would have thought this would be like 3.5, a little bit higher than the average player. Mm. This is close to double what the average player is attacking. So if a deck is built for combat, it's actually pretty successful at pulling off some combat, which is nice. And I liked hearing that, even though I think for myself, it was kind of, I'm going to have to speak about it in the future a little bit differently, I think, knowing this now.
Well, it's really interesting to think about, because maybe it means that the general trend of Commander, and I think it's gone this way, is like build a value engine, you know, Dirtle on your own side, do things like that. We've talked about it a little bit here. Maybe it has actually opened up a little bit of space for the combat players to be a little more successful than they normally would too. Because that's sort of the thing that I've always been like, if you're swinging out all the time, you're not doing the thing that I think gets you closer to a win, unless you're all about attacking.
Yeah. Let's talk about some outliers. There were 9 attacks in a game twice. There were 8 attacks in a game 4 times.
Okay.
8 attacks in a game. That's a lot. I mean, those might have been the games where it went 15 turns. I don't know.
Yeah.
But still, there were no games, not a single game in the entire sample, where at least one player didn't attack less than 3 times.
I see.
Now, one thing we have to say, there's caveats and things, and I kind of wish we had... gathered this data and taken into account like the amount of damage done. Obviously, we're under a time constraint when we're gathering the data, and you can't list out a million data points. But it would have been nice to be able to filter out like the
how much damage early, like
the early
the first
game
attack.
Doesn't mean anything. Yeah, attacks, yeah. Like, you know, yeah, swinging with your just because you happen to have a 2 CMC commander and you're just like, well, it's a Hapatra, I'm just gonna swing.
I've seen the attacks where it's like we can both block and they'll bounce off and I get an effect off it. Yeah. So give me that, you know, for political gain.
So it would have been nice to just be able to filter it by damage done. We weren't able to do that, so who knows. And also it would have been nice to count the number of attackers, I think, just to kind of see how many of these attacks are like meaningful.
It'd be interesting to know, right, if the deck averaged 5 attacks a game. It was a swarm token swarm deck, so it always could attack.
Yeah.
Or it was a Voltron, or it was a Greven deck, right? It had the ways to get about it. It would be interesting to see, because the number of creatures does matter.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see also, like, oh, 3 of those attacks were for, you know, less than 3 damage, but the last attack was for 90. You know what I mean? Like, who knows?
Crater Hoof.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, obviously, there's limitations to the data, but I think we both can agree that, or at least my takeaway from this is that if you build your deck to be focused on combat, it's going to be able to do that more often than I would have thought.
Yeah, and maybe this just means that combat is being a bit undervalued overall.
Maybe.
So that's how I kind of feel like that.
All right, so what does this mean if we have this info? How can it affect our deck building? And like...
Good blockers might go a long way.
Yeah.
We've seen Death Touch just hold back entire armies before, and I think it's tough sometimes, right? Like... There are situations where, let's say, I'm the only attacker and I have 3 opponents. 2 of them are really good blockers, but I can get around them if I want. I'll just lose something in the process. One person's wide open.
Wide open person every time.
Wide
right?
open every time. Yeah. And then you're going to keep focusing on them. So having just a little bit of a stopgap between you and an attacking player might make a bigger difference now.
Yeah, if there's going to be one player in a pod that's kind of going to be the combat player and attack more than the average... Right, because if you think, if everybody averages out to 2.86 attacks per game, if one person is taking that large of a slice of it, one player is taking more than 5 of the attacks, everybody else is actually attacking a little bit less than that 2.86, right? Because that's the way averages work. And so if you can make sure that that player is not attacking you, that actually becomes an advantage for you.
Right.
Yeah. So thwarting an early attack or making sure they're deflected early might be a really important thing for decks to be doing.
Yeah, get their sights on someone else and don't give them a reason to keep coming after you.
All right, so we know this info. How should this affect our in-game decision-making? And I think that what we just said could apply to in-game decisions, too, is giving your deck tools to deflect and thwart the combat player, but also playing in such a way. Maybe playing a creature out that you wouldn't normally play as early just to have it as a blocker that thwarts an attack. Like, I'll do this against Craig all the time. It's like, I have Gutter Snipe in my hand. I'd like to hold it and cast a bunch of instant sorceries to kill people later. But I also like Craig to just not attack me and hit somebody else with his Infect, because once he's got Infect on somebody, he almost has to go after them.
Right.
So I'll cast my Gutter Snipe and be like, hey, whatever, I'll block with it.
Yeah, you know I'm going to block with it because I don't know what you have in your hand. Craig's like, every single creature attacking is so valuable, I can't risk it.
And he'll do what you said. I'll just attack the freebie then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, there's an interesting point here you wrote about the stat line. And I was thinking about this too, in that maybe we are undervaluing creatures that have power of three or four because they are good traders, and a lot of times the creatures that are attacking might be an x4 or an x3, and especially if it's not like a random token or there's some value generated on it or it's a commander, you don't want to risk that because they know they have good blockers. If you have a bunch of 1/1s or just even a couple of small guys, it might be easier for them to attack and be like, yeah, sure, chump. But in this case, if it's a sure trade, different story.
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to do it. This actually made me rethink something we've sort of touted on this show before, and I think it was with DJ, so I won't I won't hold you accountable for this, Jimmy. But we definitely talked about the card Eternal Witness as a card that we thought was overrated, and I often will play like Regrowth instead of Eternal Witness because I feel like that one mana,
it's cheaper.
I don't need that 2/1 body. If I don't have a way to blink it or recur it from my graveyard, then I'd rather just have the spell that does the thing without the extra mana. But the 2/1 body might actually just be worth more than I'm giving it credit for, even as just a blocker, because if attacks are going to happen more often than I think, and specifically if you want to be able to thwart, you know, the combat player and deflect them, then maybe that explains one of the reasons why Eternal Witness is so high on that popularity list.
Maybe that same goes for Reclamation Sage too, then.
Maybe
same,
even same Birds idea. Of Paradise, which I've said is...
Dude, the best flying blocker of all time, Birds of Paradise.
Maybe
it's
better than I thought. I've said it's over. I thought it was overrated in the past, but maybe not. Maybe because I'm underrating the blocking aspect of it.
Right. I would love to hear the audience chime in on this one, especially because I think there are so many types of Magic players. Some people will hold a combat and attack into a much higher standard, and some people will undervalue it like what we do, and some people might completely discount it.
I definitely have been undervaluing it.
Oh, yeah, me too. I mean, based on just this discussion, I'm like, I need to play some more 1/1 Death Touchers. Where's my Ophiomancer? The greatest card ever now. Yep.
All right, let's talk about, we're going to go to the last point of discussion, and this is board wipe frequency. So we just thought, well, I don't know that we've spoken about this on the show specifically, but we thought while we were in there, this is a data point we could gather and it would be interesting.
Yeah, it's great.
So we were asking, how often are board wipes occurring during games on average? I wanted to note, even if the board wipe destroys only one permanent type, or even if it's somewhat limited, like damage-based or something that only hits, you know, creatures 4 CMC or more or something, we still classified it as a board wipe. So, for example, Vandal Blast, if somebody cast that overloaded, we would still say it's a board wipe. Right. Retribution of the Meek, we still count it as a board wipe.
Yeah. Right. If you're counting it as a board wipe in your deck building, I think it counts as one here.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So on average, what do you think the average... Well, you've looked at it
I've
now.
Seen okay. it now, yeah.
I'm going to ask the audience real quick. On average, how many board wipes do you think are cast per game by the entire table? What is 1.32, Alex?
Wow, I would have thought more.
Yeah, I would have too.
I feel like 10 board wipes get cast a game. But maybe when someone just removes a single creature of mine, I'm just like, it's all over. It may as well be a board wipe. You know, I think this is much lower than I expected, because especially with the note being like, oh, we're including Vandal Blast? Well, then we're definitely...
We're being liberal in how we're classifying it.
Yeah.
In which case, you would think there would be more. Yeah, 1.32. So there's less than two board wipes, significantly less than two board wipes cast in your average game.
Interesting.
I definitely would have thought it would be more. Let's talk about some outliers.
Okay.
There was one game, only one, where four board wipes were cast in the entire study. Again, about 50 games.
Yep.
In 23% of all the games, zero board wipes of any kind were cast.
Now, I'd be interested to know what the average turn amount of those games are, because I'd reckon it'd be a little lower.
You'd think it'd be faster, but I don't know. Yeah.
I'm just actually just so surprised that so many few board wipes are cast. But then again, let's say people are going by our standard of deck building, which is like we recommend around 5 mass removal spells in your deck. The chance of you drawing one, not that high. Then, right?
Yeah, unless you're tutoring it out. There's only 10 turns in the game, we think. So,
yeah.
You know.
So that could potentially contribute to that as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to square this with other things we think or know about the format, but it is just interesting that I think I've been more scared of board wipes when building and playing than the data actually says I should be.
Yeah. Also, I'd be wondering, right, if people are tutoring for stuff, how often are they tutoring for an answer to the board? How often are they tutoring for something to benefit their own board, right? Like, and that might affect it a little bit too. I do think that the fear of board wipes might be what's driving this down. If you don't want board wipes in the game, you're not going to play them as much either.
Maybe.
Because you know it does set you back sometimes, and even though you might get insane value, it might need you to cast your commander again, and that's just actually not acceptable at this point in the game.
That's a good point. Okay, so what does this mean? We have the info. How does it affect deck building? One thing I thought of was we like cards that avoid board wipes, like Heroic Intervention, Teferi's Protection. I think those cards are still good, but I think you have to be careful. You don't want a lot of them. Because if there's not going to be a lot of board wipes played in a game, you don't need Boros Charm and Heroic Intervention and Teferi's Protection in your hand.
Right.
Boros Charm, obviously, a little better because it will do multiple things, but you just don't need a lot of redundancy for that effect.
Yeah, you don't need direct answers to board wipes. Heroic Intervention is nice because it can stop pinpoint removal. Teferi's Protection is nice because it can stop you from being swung out by a thousand creatures, right? So there's those aspects to it. So I think when you're evaluating those cards, don't put cards in your deck as anti-board wipe.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you're playing like a counterspell deck, maybe you shouldn't just be holding it for a board wipe. Maybe you should be holding it and using it on something that's actually more threatening, because the board wipes may not be as common as you think.
So how should this info affect our in-game decision-making? I think obviously you can probably be less afraid of committing to the board.
Right.
Especially after the first board wipe, because you know there's unlikely to be more than one in a game, but there is likely to be one.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, thinking back to Game Night's games, this is a thing that often happens, which is a person takes command of the early game,
mm-hmm.
and they get off to an early lead, and then a board wipe happens. And then the person who recovers the fastest from that first board wipe is often victorious in the game.
Tends to steamroll over everyone else.
Because there's not a second big answer that's coming. So when they get their commanding lead, the resources have already been used to stop the first person, and there's not enough left to stop the second.
Right. It's the Kingmaker thing, the King of the mm-hmm. Hill thing we always see, which is you spend so much effort dragging the first person down, someone else is just climbing up the back. And you didn't realize it, but the board wipe didn't stop their mana rocks from going away, and they're able to recover really quickly. Yeah. I mean, that was how Wes, one of our old friends, built his decks. It was a 5-color, just like bunch of good stuff. And the end game was play 2 Eldrazi and then destroy everyone's lands.
Yeah, then play Armageddon.
Yeah, like, what are you going to do? Yeah, he got it.
It also might mean that casting a board wipe is not the best. It might be kind of bad because you're the last one to recover from
right.
it. Like, if you go Austere Command, blow everything
six mana,
up.
Yeah. Right.
And then what can you do that turn? You can't do much else. So you pass, and Jimmy goes, play a bunch of stuff, recover.
Bunch of stuff.
You know, Mel goes, play a bunch of stuff. Ashlyn goes, play a bunch of stuff. And it comes back to you, and you're like, crap.
I just reset the turn order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all I really did. And also, we know the game is not going to go long enough. It's, you know, because you just cast Austere Command, so it's probably turn 7-8, right?
Yeah.
You only got 2 turns left in the game, so your ability to recover now, so it just might actually not be correct to play a lot of board wipes, because by the time you use one to solve your problem, you actually can't, it doesn't solve your problem. It just makes somebody else win.
Maybe instead of putting board wipes in your deck that are just there to solve, like to just protection or just in case, your board wipe should be strategically positioned with the strategy of your deck.
Yeah,
too.
It's Retribution of the Meek. It's trying to be one-sided.
Yeah, it's trying to be that.
Yeah.
Or also, you know you're really weak to artifacts, so you have to put a Vandalblast in there.
And you don't play a lot of artifacts, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it also shows why Instant Speed and Cyclonic Rift are so, so good. Because think of Cyclonic Rift in the same Austere Command example. You don't cast it on your turn. You cast on the end step before your turn. And now you're the first one to redeploy stuff.
Yep.
Actually, Cyclonic, you don't even have to redeploy. You're still out there. But like, even if you were behind in that game, everybody else has no stuff on board, and you're still advancing your board.
And you may have had a turn cycle where someone used an instant to remove something or played a sorcery that they can't get back.
Yeah, and so you catapult into the lead now.
Yeah.
Yeah, really interesting stuff.
And then you get ganged up on.
And
maybe it all balances out right in the end.
All right, that's it for this mini stats episode. This hopefully clearing up some myths and misconceptions. Definitely, like,
it shook us to our core, Josh.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I learned some stuff here I think is interesting, and I think we'll be referring to this quite often as we continue this type of discussion, because we talk about combat, how many times you cost your commander, how long games are all the time, and it's nice to have a better barometer than just like what we think. Again, small sample size. But it's better than just like
nothing. It's better than nothing. Yeah. There's some information here. I think this is also definitely going to help us with card evaluation.
Yeah.
Commanders, right? If it's a 7 CMC commander, it's like you got to build your deck with a bunch of ramp and be able to protect this thing or just not worry if it gets removed. Otherwise,
Yeah, it better be awesome.
Better be awesome.
Okay.
Or just a 2-mana Kinder, Kieran, whatever his name is.
Kinnan, yeah. one quick thing I want to note is we're not going to release the data for this episode quite yet because we're going to fold that into the data
for a
follow-up to our big stats episodes from a couple years ago. We're in the process of sort of getting that under control because it's a really big project, but we wanted to go really deep, get a big sample size. I'm hoping to get up to something like 1,000 games worth of data so we can really, like, you know, so the sample size thing is not a caveat that we have to mention. So we're not going to release the data yet. We'll release it when we release all that data at the end of this thing, which is probably months away, but eventually you'll be able to get hold of it. And on that note, if you enjoyed this video and this type of discussion, you should check out our episodes number 238 and 239, which are our two stats episode, which are very, very similar to this one as far as taking data and really crunching it down.
And this is something that we've talked about for a long time, but this is one of the hardest things to gather data for. We don't know 90, I would say a huge percentage of Commander Magic players. We don't even know what they're playing, how they're playing it, why they're playing it the way they do. We're very much on the more dedicated side of the game, so that's the lens that we have to look at this through. So it's just something to keep in mind.
All right, to the listeners, how can we continue this type of discussion and what questions should we ask or what data points should we gather?
Are there any like blind spots here that we're missing? Like, you said all that stuff, but did you think about this?
Yeah. And that's always sitting around going, well, what else could we ask when watching the game as a data point that we could keep track of? And what question would that answer? So if you have a good one, please put it in the comments, tweet at us, email us. You know how to get at us. All right. And make sure that you go to cardkingdom.com/command zone when you're ordering all your Magic products, singles. You know, M21 is right around the corner. Ikoria still available. Double Masters coming out soon.
Commander Legends later in the year.
Yeah, C20 product. They were sold out for a while. They have it back in stock. So if you want that, haven't gotten a hold of it or want more of it,
jump on it.
Yep, definitely jump on it for cardkingdom.com/command zone. They are the best place to go. They're back up and running. They're going to have your stuff too as fast as possible. Like Jimmy said,
they take that super too. They take it super seriously. But they're like majorly understaffed and they're still working their butts off. I placed an order yesterday and got a shipping confirmation today. So I believe things are speeding up. So
yeah, they're back. I don't know if it's full operations, but I ordered some cards too for my Obosh deck. So and I got the confirmation and they're coming very quickly. So
nice. That's great. And of course, Ultra Pro, big sponsor of the show. I want to see your cool Ultra Pro setups. We've been talking about it for so long, but we've never actually seen what y'all are rocking out there. You see the playmats that we have every day. There's a reason that we trust them. There's a reason that for 5+ years now, we've been using some of the same playmats to dress our sets, put on our desk because the product lasts and it's great at protecting your stuff, as well as putting your nice, shiny, awesome cards into Eclipse sleeves.
Yeah, that's the thing I love about Eclipse sleeves is like once I got a deck in that, it's good for years.
It's good for years, I haven't replaced a single Eclipse sleeve deck yet, and I've been playing them for 3 years now, I think.
Yeah, ever since Eclipse sleeves hit the market. Yeah, pretty crazy how good quality their stuff is. All right, now it's time for the end step where we talk about something cool outside the world of Magic.
I got one.
Oh, sweet. Thanks.
So, you know, obviously, there's a lot going on in the world right now. 2020 could not be... I don't think Nostradamus could have even predicted any amount of accuracy what's happening this year. And so we turned to media. And so I've been watching a lot of Netflix. Josh and I have talked about a lot of shows here. And one show that I just checked out, it's very binge-worthy. It's 7 episodes. Adult content warning, though. It is a bit more lewd and, I guess, there's nudity and all sorts of stuff. But it's Ryan Murphy, the guy that made Glee, made a show called Hollywood.
And I've never even heard of it.
You saw Watchmen, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so Watchmen was like, we're going to present an alternate version of history, and this is the consequences of afterwards. Hollywood is set back in the sort of like right after the silent film movie era ended, and it takes place with a fictional studio called Ace Studios, and it's basically an alternate history of how a bunch of people that are minorities or in the LGBTQ community are able to create a project out of just sheer circumstance and like make this amazing film. So it's almost like an alternate rewriting of like, what if Hollywood did make movies like this back then? And it's very signature Glee. It's like got lots of soapy elements to it. All the characters are like the most beautiful actors you've ever seen in your life. But for me, it was like very interesting because afterwards I watched it and I went, wow, I can't believe Anna May Wong finally won an Oscar. Like, I literally, yeah, yeah, part of me was like, that's great. Like, we didn't have to change history, but we were given an ability to see a different version that I think was like really, really interesting. Almost. Yeah. And for someone that's interested in movies as well, it has a lot of that sort of process of breaking it down. It's all very fantastical in the same way that Glee was. And it does have similar like high school lunchroom drama settings, but it's a very fun watch. If you are a fan of Glee, I think you would appreciate this.
What streaming service is it on?
It's on Netflix. Okay. Called Hollywood. And again, nudity, adult content warning. Definitely don't watch this one around the kids. And I'd say you'd have to be interested in a few things before you're like able to sit down and really sit through it. And I think I outlined it there.
Sounds cool. I haven't even heard of it, so I will check it out.
Yeah.
We're just always looking for things to watch because we're at home so much right now.
Yeah.
All right. Big thanks to our editing, graphics, and logistics team, which is Ashlyn Rose, Craig Blanchett, Lady Danger, Manson Lung, Josh Murphy, Jake Boss, Alfred Estaca, and Sam Waldo.
Woohoo! And of course, big thanks, Jeffrey Palmer. As always, Living Card Animation is behind us here on set, and they start and end our show at youtube.com/TheCommandZonePodcast. Say hi to Jeffrey on Twitter at LivingCardsMTG.
All right, everybody. Thanks for watching.
And we'll see you next time.
Peace!
For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.